Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 145, being recorded on the 21st of September, 2016, with special guest, Christina Compe. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest. And Kale, I believe you're in China, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm in Shanghai at the moment, at the conference we talked about last week, the DevCon.
That's right. Yeah, how's it going over there?
That's good. It kind of leads into some of our things in the news that we have here, but yesterday we made some announcements around some things we're doing in the blockchain space, specifically around the blockchain as a service and Project Bletchley. So you can go out and take a look at those. It's on the blog. There's two main things there. One is Marley Gray, our lead here in the engineering side, is actually was here on stage presenting, you know, more details about the cryptlet fabric and cryptlets and how that technology is going to be working. Those things are still being built, but there's a lot of interesting features and things that we're working on there from both software and hardware side that was pretty well received. And then on the other side was our engineering group released a new template out there. It's out in GitHub. And you can go out and spin up a consortium-based network, which basically means a private blockchain of X amount of nodes. So this is something that we've been kind of working on. You know, there's a lot of single VM images for, like, development purposes for blockchain out there. And those are great, you know, when you're doing development because you want to have a quick rev time and all that kind of thing. But then when you want to start to make it a little bit more real and you actually want to see this working with multiple nodes and the whole consensus algorithm working, that's what this is aimed at. So this is using the guest client and creating a private blockchain. So
it's like an ARM template or something they have up there?
Yeah. Yeah. If you look at the blog post, it kind of explains it. We actually have a white paper, but it kind of describes what's going on. There's some links out there to that to explain how the network's set up and why we set it up that way, like keeping the mining nodes off the internet and things like that. So it's interesting to read through. And yeah, anybody can spin it up right now. It spins up, I think, like 5 VMs at the minimum level when you stand it up. But interesting.
So I gotta ask Kale, and then you know we'll get off your blockchain favorite, but the thing that caught my attention when I was looking at this blog just briefly was the statement of, you know, it typically, you know, around 3 weeks to set up this consortium, and with the template this is down to like less than 10 minutes. Is that hyperbole or is that real?
No, that's real.
Wow.
If you've done this, it's a lot of configuration to do when you, I mean, anybody can go stand these things up, right? But it's like, yeah, just because anybody can do it doesn't mean it happens in 5 minutes. You know, you have to go do a bunch of configuration manually. This automates, you know, that kind of thing. And the idea is that we can use this as kind of like a reference implementation, and we can other ones. I mean, there's tons of blockchains out here, so we could say, hey, you could plug into this as well from a different partner or a different software vendor and do the same thing. So,
wow, that's cool.
Very nice. Well, we're going to have to schedule a session on Bletchley at some point in the future, Kale.
Yep.
All right. So, Evan, is there anything else on the new and improved list that you want to pick up?
The build the cloud apps at warp speed, I mean, this is something I think we chatted about this at one point around the capability. I know we haven't – at some point we ought to reach out to one of the PMs over there to kind of get some sense. But this is really pulling – this is about leveraging the combination of Flow, Microsoft Flow, Power Apps, and then Azure Functions, kind of merging these together in a visual designer to allow you to really just kind of drag and drop. It's like the old DB6 days, right? Drag and drop and tie everything together, and here I have this app really quickly.
Right. And it's running in the cloud, by the way.
Yeah. It really seems like it has a lot of potential. It seems like if we get all these tie-ins to the different services where you can kind of you know, point and click, tie these things together. Yeah, I can see lots of people who are not developers in the traditional sense going to be able to do things.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of the Power App demos, and those are nice for building business applications, but they're missing the back end stuff, and yeah. It's nice to have the Microsoft Flow and functions tied up together to do that now.
Yep,
that should be cool. Well, so I caught the news about the Azure Mobile Apps Node SDK version 3.0 upgrade, and as you know, that's the really nice feature where you can basically type in some Node code up in the browser and access it from a mobile application, almost like an instant API that you can put out there. And it's got a little database that it creates for you, some tables and things like that. So they've added some new functions like data transform, some filters, some hooks, the functionality. They've improved some of the querying and things like that. So there's a bunch of updates with this version 3.0 update to the Node SDK. So that's something for folks who use that to watch out for.
Cool.
What else? What else do you guys like over here? There's stuff about the Data Factory that's supposed multiple. Have any of you guys used the Azure ML recently?
I have not.
No.
Yeah, nor have I.
I did a bunch of I guess experiments, as they call it, in Azure ML, and it's really nice how you could try to make sense of some of the data. You know, I've been trying to do it at my customer, trying to do like some sort of predictive analysis of their data, of the operational data, to figure out when they might have a problem. You know, try to give them an idea beforehand when a problem might occur before it actually happens. And some of the nice features of that is that you could call a web service and then pass the input to the web service, to some of these blocks in the experiment. And some of the updates that they put out is like, a common use is to use Data Factory. Data Factory ties in all these various steps within your flow. And one of them could be, the final step could be executing this Azure ML batch execution, and now you have this feature where you can have multiple web services providing input into a single ML batch execution, which was not possible before. So that's the new update that's been announced there. Okay, I think that kind of covers all the news. So we'll turn the mic over to Christina, and Christina, I was wondering if you could just start by giving our listeners a brief introduction about your background and what you do at Microsoft, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, let's see. My background. Originally, I'm an aerospace engineer. I started my career flying the Hubble Space Telescope back in the 90s. And then I moved into computers, and I've worked for companies like America Online and VeriSign and Department of Defense before being picked up by Microsoft. I used to run a Java product development organization. That was my previous gig before coming to Microsoft. And here at Microsoft, I work as a program manager on a lot of the enterprise and hybrid capabilities for the Azure App Service, and also Java because, I did all that Java stuff. So,
and we care about Java these days, right? I mean,
actually, we care a lot about Java.
I know. I mean, so big.
Microsoft has totally 180'd on Java in the past 3 years, where it's like, no, C#, that is the shizzle. And I have to agree that I like C# as a language and stuff, but there's this huge ecosystem around Java that is undeniable, and Microsoft is totally jumping on the bandwagon and doing a lot in Azure for it.
Now, before we get into some of the discussion on how we, how best to run Java apps on Azure, at least when I think about Java, I think of, I guess, Oracle, right? That's the company that sort of owns Java.
These days.
And, I kind of remember that. I seem to recall that, we don't necessarily have the best of relationships with Oracle. How does that work, from a product development or being able to leverage that technology on our platform?
It's funny you asked about that. You would think that Oracle and Microsoft are adversarial in some way, shape, or form, but truth is that Microsoft is the world's largest licensed distributor of Java I said the world's largest. So we are the largest distributor of Java. We have a contract with Oracle, and so this is all on the up and up, you know, and none of those pesky lawsuits like what Google's had to dance around with. We are working with them, I guess, in part as a partner for this. But at the same time, we're not beholden only to the Oracle version of Java. There's another version out there from Azul, which is built on the OpenJDK project. And that distribution is called Zulu. And Microsoft's actually a pretty heavy contributor for it. And the whole idea is it is API, it is the same as Oracle Java in terms of capability, behavior, etc. Every time there's a Java release from Oracle, we get one also from Zulu, get a Zulu one. Now, we haven't really, in App Service, really fully embraced going with both the Oracle and the Zulu distros. And so one of the changes we're working on now is actually being able to give customers the choice. So they can pick to use the Oracle one or they can use the Zulu one. They're at a customer discretion.
Wow. So we're really going above and beyond here in terms of supporting Java on our platform.
Well, we still have a ways to go. I mean, to be completely honest, you know, the Java is still new in many ways for a large swath of the company. And so the capabilities that we have for it lag behind what we've got for .NET. But that will be fast changing. Java has definitely been recognized as a very important technology that we need to embrace and love and give a lot of attention to. So you should be seeing a lot more progress in this space in the coming months. I can't give details because, you know, I can't give details. But I'll simply say that we love the Java, and we're in Seattle, and I don't just mean coffee. I do mean the programming language.
I mean, so I have this, you know, I used to support Java database connectivity back in the day when our version of loving Java was, hey, we were going to be nice enough to release a Java driver. Right, for SQL Server. And I had this vague recollection of there being, you know, a Java distro from, I want to say, like IBM, and then at the time it was Sun, you know, not Oracle, and then there was a third one. And it was always a challenge, you know, because a lot of things didn't work on one that worked on the other. There were enough differences that it was problematic to move from one to the other. It is kind of the intent with Zulu to, you know, be able to move to Zulu fairly seamlessly and kind of get the benefits of, hey, they have all this development that used to work on the Oracle Java, but not necessarily be tied to that kind of owned distro? Is that kind of the vision behind that?
That is definitely the vision. Now, I will be, again, honest and say that early on, the OpenJDK project was perhaps not binary compatible, as we shall say, with the Oracle distro. But it goes through the same battery of tests now as the Oracle distro. It is heavily exercised to make sure that what Zulu releases – I sound like a spokesperson for Zulu. But what's released for Zulu is a match and works the same as the Oracle one. That's one of the cornerstones to how this is working out. There are some small differences, like in the packaging. So, like, you're not going to see JVisual VM shipped with the Zulu distro as one example, or the JProfiler package, which is fine by me because within the Azure App Service, PaaS service, you can't use those anyhow. So that saves me some disk space. So I don't bemoan that too much. But now it is definitely in all our tests, we found binary compatibility. That doesn't mean we believe it without the whole hog, you know, without full testing.
Right.
We still are looking at it. It's one of those that's too good to be true. But if you take a look across Azure, a lot of our other Java-based services are already using Zulu Java instead of the Oracle one. And that means no disrespect to the Oracle distribution, in case Larry Ellison is listening.
I'll have to be honest. I mean, it was probably, you know, 4-5 years ago that I was heavily in that space, and I've never heard of Zulu before this. So I'm going to have to go do some digging now to kind of understand where that sits within the world.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty good little package. I mean, if you played around with the OpenJDK thing back several years ago, then you'd be like, well, I don't know about this. But honest to God, they've done a lot of work to make this pretty tight. And Microsoft's heavily invested in trying to make it solid because we want to make sure we have, you know, cloud options. Hopefully our partnership stays strong with Oracle, but there's a lot to be lost if we were to, you know, not make sure to cater to our Java customers.
Right. Right.
Now, we've talked about on the show, we have talked about a lot about obviously running ASP.NET apps, you know, in Azure and even some Node apps, PHP, Python, we all hear about all those things. So, you know, in the kind of spectrum of all the various technologies and platforms that we support in Azure, you know, give us a sense for where Java fits in that spectrum, like, you know, in terms of maturity or even in terms of support.
Sure. So right now I'm going to only talk to app service. I know there's other capabilities being built elsewhere, but just to make sure I stay within my domain of expertise, I'll stay in app service. We've got a few forms of the feature. We've got one that caters more to the customer who just wants to upload a WAR file, and you can configure that from the portal or via API and say that, you know, hey, I want to have a Tomcat server, Java 8, and I just want to be able to upload a WAR file. And great, that one you can be up and running, you know, in just a matter of minutes. Another one, though, for customers who want a lot more control over their Tomcat install or Jetty, is you can deploy that from the gallery. And when you do that, you can configure Tomcat. You can edit the libraries and libshared. You can edit the server XML to your heart's content, contacts XML, etc. In that first form where it's enabled from the UI, the Tomcat server is actually inside our program file space, and so it's uneditable. So we have it set up to run your basic things, but if you need to do things that are more complex involving surgery to the web server, then yeah, you can upload your own. And then the third form is that you can just upload any old Java application you want. You have to configure the web config file to set I'm getting a little too deep here, but the HTTP platform handler so that it'll behave properly. We have documentation on it. And that one little item, the HTTP platform handler, is something worth calling out. It's something we added for IIS, and it's now distributed with .NET Core. And it allows you to essentially make IIS behave like ARR. And so it can basically proxy over your request to another process. And this is useful for a mix of things where you have IIS in the picture like we do in app service. In terms of maturity, going back to that part of the question, we still have a ways to go. Like we don't have an ability to integrate with a GitHub repo that has your source code and then compile on your behalf and deploy. We'd have to compile all your Java code separately, and then you install your binaries.
So it sounds like you could, you know, build a manual process on top of this to, you know, to push your stuff out automatically. But even if you had to, you know, manually upload files, that you're still getting the kind of the launching and the management within the web apps is really kind of handled for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, the big thing you got is once you get your Java app published, then you've got all the benefits of all the capabilities within the app service that you have for any other framework. You can use deployment slots, so you can have, you know, staging site. You can scale your site with the drag of a mouse. You can integrate with something like Dropbox for doing a CI level system, even though you're managing your own builds. You can take advantage of the hybrid connectivity capabilities such as hybrid connections or VNet integration, etc., so you have access to on-premise resources. Basically, all the capabilities that you have within app service work across all of our frameworks and languages, and that includes Java. So that is a pretty rich and powerful set that you get just off the bat.
Yeah, so let me make sure I understand this. So I think what I just heard you describe, that if I take a, you know, some random Java code and then I package it up, upload it into app services, because I'm in app services, all the functionality that I have in app services comes along for the ride. Kudu, you know, VNet integration, on-premises connectivity. So, wow, that's amazingly powerful then.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fantastic. I love playing with this thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry. Just one question I had about that. How does the app settings, you know, where we have those like settings that we can actually put up in like the portal or through the API, does that just come through as like environment variables, or does that, how does that work with Java?
See, now you're getting more specific. So it's a good and legitimate question. So those are actually passed into IIS. And so because your Java application is not in proc, it's not aware of these things. So if you were to set, I don't know, connection strings and stuff like that, you do have to manage that separately oriented around your process. Because your Java process can be anything. I mean, it could be, I've had customers with Java 6 apps that they deployed, large scale customers, I'll add, with Java 6. And they had their own custom configuration. We've had other customers with their own POJO applications, you know, where it wasn't running in a web server, but they had their own HTTP listener, and that still worked. The bumps, go ahead.
I was going to say, so you basically ended up building kind of the equivalent to PaaS cloud services, but in that, one of the big limitations there was you never could do, you know, Java or anything like that. You can do that now, in essence.
Yeah, this is the secret back door that lets you basically run whatever you want. We run Go this way. You can pull Go from the gallery, and this is how we do it. I've tried all sorts of things using this HTTP platform handler, and essentially, as long as your process can listen on an environmental variable for the HTTP listen port, then hey, you are pretty much good to go. There are some restrictions, like your app servers, like JBoss or WebSphere, WebLogic. Those aren't going to work well because they really need to have other ports open. Part of our security sandbox restrictions involve limiting you to opening that one HTTP port. And so if you feel compelled by developer almighty that you must listen on another port for something else, then you're going to have a problem in our environment. So that usually covers all your app servers. They don't run too well, but all the web servers seem to play nicely in our house.
Does that, I guess the question I have maybe for our listeners would be like, this sounds great that we can basically run our basic, or not even basic, some advanced Java applications in here. But what would compel somebody beyond what you just said? Are those like the big driving points for saying, you know, instead of using app service, I should use like a full IaaS VM and manually install these kind of pieces, and which is much more management. But what kind of compels somebody to choose one over the other?
Right. And so within Azure, we do have the complete story, right? You can install on IaaS VMs. And there are two cases. One is where you want to use one of those app servers, like I noted, like JBoss or Glassfish, et cetera. And in those cases, I say you're going to need to use ISVMs at this point because they just have needs that don't work in our sandbox. The other case would be if they have some other library call that's a violation of our security restrictions. You got to remember that the app service is a multi-tenant service, and so we have to make sure that we have it locked down as tight as we possibly can, and so that we have a no interference policy, you know, so that nobody's app can interfere with anybody else. And this isn't a Java thing. These rules are enacted for everybody. It's not specific to Java.
So do you have a way? I mean, I know this stuff is published. I've seen some of the limitations, but is there a way that, you know? So I want to run this Java app in App Services. Is there a way for me to kind of inspect it and see whether I'm going to run afoul of some of the, you know, kind of restrictions we put on it? So that there's no conflict, or do I just need to put it up there and see what works and what doesn't?
I hate doing it that way.
it keeps me in business and support, right? But, you know, that's probably not the ideal way.
No, what I tell customers to look at, and I tell them this whether it's Java or anything else, is do you need to have another port open? Do you want to open a UI thread? Do you need to change the fonts on the host? You know, are you trying to do something that affects the entire system? If you are, then you're going to have bumps. That probably isn't going to work. And that's, you know, again, not language specific. It's across the board. There's nothing that we say that you can't do in Java that you can do in another language, if that makes a modicum of sense.
Now, Christina, I know from what little I know of Java when I used to do it a few years ago, I believe there are some Java runtime takes certain parameters, right, like the amount of memory you want to allocate mm-hmm. to the process and things like that. So how much flexibility does the application developer have if they choose the option one that you described, which is the fully managed service?
So if you pick the fully managed service, then you can pick between the 32-bit and the 64-bit hosting level, which does then give you the same memory settings based off of Windows, based off of whatever the version of Java is, and your bitness, whether it's 32-bit or 64. If you need that complete control on the actual path, then you can use the web config and you can set it by hand. Now, the cute thing here is that even if you use the web config and you set everything by hand because you want to, you can point to the instances of Tomcat and Java that are in our program files. Just because you want to use the web config and get really deep and dirty on all that doesn't mean you can't use the stuff that we have installed there.
I see.
So that gives you a certain amount of savings where you're not managing that. You're able to, you know, basically lean on what we already have installed. And there's a lot of, you know, developer benefit in that capability. I will admit we need more versions in there of both of Java and of Tomcat. The reason we don't have the sun, the moon, the stars is we do have some disk space restrictions. Anything we install is installed across all of our workers. And so right now, that's something of a restriction. Mm. We have a few ideas, though, that we're looking to try to change that up, but that's not going to be around for a little while. So in the meantime, we are trying to just slowly roll out new versions about every 6 months.
I see. I know one of the other options in the Java command line was related to debugging or profiling, I think, if memory serves me right. So how can the developer use their profiling tools if they want to see whether the Java program is running the way they normally run in on-premises server, for example?
Right. Well, there's in terms of profiling your applications, you can use things like App Insights, which, funny enough, was working with Java in Azure Web Apps before it was working for .NET.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it kind of embarrassed
modern Microsoft.
It was definitely an irony moment. I'm not going to say that it embarrassed the .NET folks to make sure it worked that way, but you know, I'm going to joke that it did. But it was interesting that Java did come before .NET in that case. But you can use a mix of different capabilities to profile your apps, just like you would for .NET. You also, in terms of remote debugging, there's a capability that you can lean on that goes with our new plugins. So, oh yeah, I ought to mention that. So over the summer, we released, by we I mean Microsoft, plugins for Eclipse and IntelliJ IDEA. And those plugins let you publish and remote debug your application, your web applications, Java web applications from those IDEs. It's pretty cool. We didn't have this earlier, but we finally got funding, and this is also somewhat indicative of, you know, the importance of Java to Microsoft and that we are investing in it. We didn't have anywhere close to this level of support inside the IDEs. And so if you want to remote debug, it's built right into the product.
So that leads me to ask the question. I mean, again, going back to my days in SQL JDBC, I used to know the couple of devs and the PM over that space, and you know, it wasn't that nobody talked to them, but they really didn't have anybody else that was doing the same thing they were doing, right? Almost nobody was doing Java code. You know, maybe some of the stuff in the SharePoint Fast space, but these days, you know, that's way more common. But it still feels like you guys in the web app space are a little bit on the leading edge of this. You know, when you're looking for, you know, these days when you hire resources, are we actively looking for people that are bringing these skills coming in, or are we kind of training up who we have, or is it, you know, ideally probably most likely a mix of both? Because, I mean, you can't just go and transfer people from, you know, C-sharp to, you know, they've been doing C-sharp for years and years and years, or C++, and say, okay, now go write really good Java code and ship something next week, right? It's the concepts are the same, but it's not that easy.
Funny enough, I actually hired C-sharp developers to do Java code. It took a little bit of training, but they did quite well at it. In terms of our hiring practices, I was actually picked up because I am pretty much all things not Microsoft from a tech base. I'm a Java connectivity girl. Linux, that's my happy place. This Windows thing, I mean, I have Windows on my car and my house. I'm a little lost here. But seriously, we do look for those differentiators. We look for people who bring new skills to the table. In addition to all the other standard ones that we lean on and depend on.
Right. Yeah, that's such a shift that, I mean, we're doing the same thing in support. You know, and Sajid, I don't know if you guys are starting to see this in the consulting space, but I mean, we're actually, you know, not, I wouldn't say that we're preferentially going for people that you know, kind of have Linux and you know, and Java and the like, but it absolutely is a major plus.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to years ago, we're like, okay, great, you know that, that's awesome. Yeah. We don't really need that.
Yeah,
right?
You have now to have that variety now. Yeah.
It's a huge shift.
Yeah. If you take a look at the programming indexes, it's really apparent the importance of Java to the market. It's number one language, I think, still for a while. It depends on which index you look at, but it's still very much in demand. It's still heavily taught in schools. It's very important, especially overseas, where like in Europe, Java is used everywhere. And then in Linux also. Though we're not talking about Linux, but Linux is an amazingly important thing. I mean, only half the world runs on Windows. The other half runs on Linux. So we don't want to exclude anybody. We love everybody.
So Christine, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Sajid.
No, I was going to say, like you mentioned, like so many people around the globe are using Java, especially out of the United States. So without naming any customer names or anything like that, can you give us a sense for what are some of the large Java installations you've seen on Java, like on Azure? How large were they? Like, do you have any sense of that?
I don't know. Let's see. I don't have any good numbers right in front of me in terms of request size, but
like
we
do run
have
on the top tier app services, you know, other web services, like the number of the larger SKUs and things like that.
Well, in terms of popularity of language, it's still low in popularity. It's more important in our higher priced SKUs, you know, where customers have a heavy investment in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Java has a higher percentage of use there. In terms of the other SKUs, pricing SKUs, where people are playing more, doesn't show up as prominently currently. But I would also say that to date, our support for Java has, you know, lagged our support for .NET, and that it's quite understandable that you would see a dominance by .NET and ASP.NET inside app service. In terms of the size and scale, I've seen Java applications by, I'm not going to give names, I'll say it was a government ran a very large site, Java-based site, that was on top of us, and they still do. And it gets quite a bit of load, has burst load periods. I don't have tight numbers right now.
That's good.
Some large European companies that are running on us as well. Their Java apps, names that everybody would know and recognize.
No, is it because do people care that we're running this Java code on Windows? Is that a detractor in some cases, or being that it's a managed service, you shouldn't care?
Well, it really depends. I mean, Java doesn't care whether you're running on Linux or whether you're running on Windows. The only thing that matters really is when you get down to I'm making a file system call and I have to deal with different pathing. by and large, outside of that, and so like the developers who are used to working in Linux and stuff, they like their deployment environment to be closer to what they work on because it's more comfortable. But having run a Java dev organization, I can tell you we built for Windows and Linux and Mac, and because we were writing in Java, we didn't care too much. You know, the application ran on everything. So it comes down to who's driving things. If the developer is driving it based on preference, then they're going to want it to be closer to their normal development environment, which tends to be, for Java, tends to be more of a Linux system thing, because that just is where they normally are. But if it's your IT shop, they're going to say, well, we don't care. We like the cloud, and we don't really care whether it's Windows or Linux, and that's one of the reasons we got into Java in the first place.
Evan, you had a question for Christina, or you got that answer?
No, I think she covered it in your conversation, because now I can't remember what it was.
Okay, no worries.
Well, I can talk about this all day at great length and great detail, but
I think this is excellent background on we just haven't covered this topic much, so I'm really glad that you suggested it and that we covered it over here. Any more questions for Christina, guys?
No, this is great. I think we may have to come back around to you with non-Java stuff as well, because it sounds like you're touching a lot of interesting stuff. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, I'd be happy to do so. And the Java topic, we can come back on that after we've made some of the changes that we're planning, maybe in the first quarter next year or something.
Well, Christina, thank you again very much. Appreciate your time. And
sure.
We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Christina.
Sure. See you guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.